Hello, and welcome to the London Writer Salon podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Parul. And each week we sit down with a writer that we admire to talk about the craft of writing and the art of building a successful and sustainable writing career.
These interviews are recorded live with our global writing community. If you would like to join us for the next recording or write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions, head to londonwritersalon.com for more information.
In this episode, we talk with the award-winning novelist and screenwriter, Tom Robb Smith. His series, The Child 44 Trilogy, was voted one of the top 100 thrillers of all time. Tom also won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for his work on American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. In this conversation with Tom, we chat about his writing journey from Cambodian soap operas to screenplays and novels, and how today, creating a treatment is integral to his planning process. We asked Tom for advice about forging a career as a writer, and he says it's important to be nimble-footed. He says, be open to opportunities that might not be on your dream scenario. There's a lot of stumbling, but you know when you come across something that you have a strong reaction to, you need to trust that. We also dive into his latest novel, Cold People. It's a sci-fi thriller set in Antarctica. It's fabulous. Tom is a talented writer, no doubt, and he's very open about the hard work that he's put into honing his craft. Well, let's begin. We hope you enjoy our conversation with Tom Robb Smith.
And if you're loving these conversations and want to help support the podcast, please rate and review us wherever you listen to us. Each month, we give away prizes to our reviewers, things like mugs and stickers and other goodies. Plus, it's just a nice way to show us your love and to help keep us going. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to the London Writer Salon, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
So lovely to have you here. We'll be digging a lot into your career today, some of the books and series that you have out now. But I'd like to start us off earlier on in your life. I'd like to take you back to when you first started really getting into reading. What are your earliest memories of reading? What kind of books were you reading, either as a child or a teenager, that still stick with you today?
Oh, I read a lot and widely, and it would never felt a chore. So it was always something I kind of delighted in. Like a lot of kids, I used it as a bit of a retreat, particularly in my teenage years. Not so much when I was like under the age of 12, but as soon as I hit kind of 12, 13 and everything got kind of difficult, I used, you know, books as a escape from school or some of the troubles at home and school difficulties. So there was kind of that escapist element. And then, you know, you follow your teacher's recommendations. And I loved narrative. I always loved the big kind of epic stories, whether they were Russian or English or French. American, I didn't really get into until I was at college and I did an American studies course. So it's kind of interesting that when you start discovering different countries, and then when I went on a Japanese book tour, that was the first time I started reading. So I was like, oh, I should read lots of Japanese literature. So you know, you move slightly according to your circumstances with reading, I think. But it was always narrative, although I enjoyed, you know, experimental literature in the sense of when you're studying it, you're sitting down with dictionaries and thesauruses, it's very interesting. I prefer the sweep of a narrative. I always like that. And being caught up in it, whether that's the Count of Monte Cristo or, you know, Crime and Punishment or the big Dickensian stories. So those are the kind of things I read a lot. Conrad, I really enjoyed when I got a bit older, 16, 17. So yeah, that, I think that is my preference. That's still my preference. And then at university, I studied English literature. So you start reading books that I hadn't studied before, like medieval. But if you were going to boil it down, it would be that kind of picking up a story and feeling like you're taken somewhere else, and that sense of not being able to put it down, and it of being a companion, that kind of energy, I think.
And that's something you definitely bring to your books. We'll be talking about your writing as well a little bit later. And staying on the theme of reading, I heard you say that when you were 17, you were a reader at a production company. You were reading like The Slush Pile. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What was that experience like?
Yeah, the slush pile is not, I did not make up that term. It's a horrible term. It just sounds really rude, but it's basically what they call is if you send in a script that is, actually sometimes it does have an agent letter with it, but it's unsolicited. So they haven't asked for it. They haven't asked you to write something. You're just sending it in a sense, cold and just saying, here's my script. What do you think of it? And they have a big stack of these. And the way they do it is I think it's kind of a, I didn't think about it at the time, because in a sense, as a, you accept things as normal or as the way they are. But looking at it now, you realize it's a kind of strange way of working, which is they hire these young, aspiring, whatever, they could be producers, directors, and they read the whole pile and they write coverage, which is, you know, a 2-page summary and your opinion on it. And they pick up the summary and your opinion and they read it, and then they decide whether they want to read it or not. And so there's this strange gatekeeper towards, you know, this pile and this summary, which I think is a bit ridiculous, because what can you really tell? And then, you know, I always try to be as positive as possible, because I was like, I don't want to feel like I'm stopping someone from reading something. So if you draw out the best, maybe they'll, you know, they'll at least read it and give it a chance. But that, you know, it was a great job in the sense that I found it really interesting. You start to see trends, you start to see how people write. I think you're, I don't know what the rate of pay is now. Some places didn't pay at all, except I think they paid expenses, i.e. your train fare to get there. And I did that for a bit, but after a while, you know, you had to kind of get paid. And so I think I got paid £25 or something a script, which I still felt was like a great amount, although it takes a while to read and write the summaries. And I did that for Channel 4 for a while, I think. And then I did it for a few independent production companies.
Can I ask how you landed those gigs, those early reader gigs?
You know, software is literally just like asking people, and people had a opening. I was quite bold in the sense I was happy to phone people up. And my parents are both, my parents worked as a team. My dad was an antique dealer. My mom sold the antiques, so that we didn't know anyone in writing or that industry. I think my dad had one friend called Serena Cullen, who worked at the BBC at the time. And so I went and I met her, and she said, oh, you know, here's a trial script. You can see if you want to write a summary of that. And then I did a few summaries for her and did a few summaries for a few other companies. But it is a good job in the sense of, you feel, I think the importance of those early years and those early stages is feeling like you're getting closer to the world you want to inhabit, like the professional world. Like, otherwise it just feels so distant, so remote, so inaccessible, that it starts to feel almost like a kind of impossible dream. And the, even those tiny little steps that seem, you know, not necessarily like a huge step in terms of progress, but they make you feel like, oh, I'm getting closer to the profession I want to do. And they were important in that sense a lot. So those are the, you know, the advantage of having to read people's work, and reading other people's work is always a great way of learning, but also that sense of, oh, okay, I'm now kind of entering a world that I want to enter. And I think it's a lot hard for lots of people who have absolutely no connection to it to feel like it's just distant and impossible and hard to break through. I think that's very frustrating.
Mm. And so were you writing at the time while you were reading these as well?
Yeah, I was lucky in the sense that I was kind of fearless, which you have to be at the beginning. I never minded the humiliation of it not being great. I just was like, you always get very excited. I think I first started writing outside of, you know, school assignments when I was like 13, 14. And then I started putting on plays. That was my really kind of big creative act when I was a teenager. And I, you know, our school had a theater, and I had a great drama teacher who was like, you should stage them. And staging them is amazing because you can see it transform. You can see what works and what doesn't work. You listen to the audience, what they like and what they don't like. And it moves from being thoughts in your head to how you put them on stage, then how that kind of triangle of things. And that to me was really useful. And, you know, you still carry on learning, which is you think something's in your head and then you see it in at a read through or on set and you have to adjust. And then you watch the audience react to it and you're like, it's completely different again. So getting a taste of that very early on was really exciting. Then at college, my university had I went to Cambridge and they had lots of different theaters, so they could put on quite a lot. But it was the first at school, because it was like they had one theater and you were known to all the students, you always got an audience, like all your friends would come, they would bring their friends. And then at college, because they had lots of colleges, there was that first competition where there were, I think, I don't know, each college had a small theater and you would put one on. And every weekend there were lots of plays going on. So it was the first time you didn't get a guarantee. I experienced not getting guaranteed audience and trying to compete against you know, so many other activities, whether it's socializing or whatever else. And some of the, you know, so you perform to say 20, 30 people and you're like, oh, wow, this is the taste of the real world, where you have to really start thinking about it as a, how do you bring people in? How do you get people to give up their time to watch something? So that was my kind of taste of that, which is tough.
And then later, we read somewhere that you wrote Cambodia's first soap opera. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I mean, I left college and I had, you know, this is the thing of having no connections with anyone. And I wondered, you know, and it's interesting because obviously I studied English literature. It was amazing. If you say at college, oh, I want to be a writer, everyone's like, oh yeah, but how are you going to make a living? It was really like, it wasn't looked upon as a sane choice. And I couldn't really articulate. I didn't know anyone. I didn't really know any writers. I knew academics, obviously, from college, but I didn't know any professional creative writers. I think someone tried to put me in touch with a writer from the Bill, but I never in the end connected with them. And I came out of college anyway with this dream. And I guess I was very lucky at the time because it was quite a lot of TV, homemade television, and there were lots of long-running TV shows. And I was reading through the newspaper and I came across an advert that said no experience necessary, which is now, you know, who, I mean, that's, I don't know if that even exists anymore, that no experience necessary line, but it was for an assistant storyline editor. And those long running shows are storylined as a group at the office. And then they farm out the storylines to different writers because they have to coordinate the stories over a long arc and a writer will write one script. And so that was my way in. So, you know, it was this pure fluke of that job being available. I went in, they liked the interaction went well. And then I worked on these long running shows for a while. You kind of move around. I found them very enjoyable. The people were really smart. Often the shows weren't, or the episodes that I worked on weren't particularly good. I mean, part of it is the budgets are minuscule. The time they're shot in is hyper quick. I mean, it's, you know, it's really insane. And so often you'd have these storylines. I mean, one that was really quite an interesting one about a character being on the brink of suicide. And we storylined it that they went down to the cliffs of Dover, and the cliffhanger was literally him standing at a cliff looking down at the sea kind of crashing against the rocks. And I was like, that's it, really. You know, he was a character who'd been in it for a while, so it felt very dramatic. Well, they obviously couldn't afford to go down to the cliffs of Dover. So in the end, he ended up, I mean, the only location they could get was this kind of small lake in a golf course, and he's kind of walking around it. And it just, you know, no one knew what it meant. And you were watching it thinking it just was, you know, that was the dream and on paper, and that was where you ended up. And there was quite a lot of that with those shows. But even that was interesting. It was like, well, you have to write what you can afford. There's no point in writing that scene if you can't go down there. So all of that stuff was really great. And actually the people that worked in those shows, really interesting. They've gone on to do amazing, amazing things, including my boss on the first show that I got, the assistant story editor, whatever, trainee story editor, is called Dominic Treadwell Collins. And he produced A Very British Scandal. So,
and then just fast forwarding to when you then landed a job on Family Affairs and Bad Girls, it sounded like your experience just kept compounding. Can you tell us a little bit about how those roles came about? Did it all start with a spec script earlier?
No, none of those were spec scripts. Those were all an interview because, you know, it wasn't a creative job in the sense of writing. Actually, I can't even remember whether I had to send in a writing sample, because that was about coming in and being able to, you know, someone would say, this is the premise for this episode. And you'd have to interact with them face to face, trying to suggest possible ideas and also let stuff go. Like if your idea wasn't what they wanted, you had to move on to another idea. You couldn't get kind of trapped in it. But all of that came about, I think, through interviews. And once you've got one job, it becomes easier to get another because then you're recommended to, I think it was a recommendation to Bad Girls. And then Bad Girls, I went to Dream Team, which was actually the first writing and not a kind of script editing. And then when I was there, that was, I should have put a pin in the Cambodia thing. That was how I got Cambodia. So after that, I'd done enough shows and I met Matthew Robinson, who was the executive producer of that show. And he'd run BBC Wales. And he had then been moved to the charitable arm of the BBC World Service Trust. I'm not sure if it exists anymore. And they had set up this show, different shows around the world. And the idea was to use the popular medium of soap to get across health messages. So in Cambodia, it was about mother-child healthcare. It was about HIV/AIDS. I think at the time, they had a really high rate of infection. And so we set up a medical soap because it's very easy to lace those kind of messages in a medical. They're kind of there anyway. So that was really interesting. And that I wasn't writing it. I was storylining it with a team of Cambodian writers who hadn't had much experience, but had gone through college and were super bright. And they were just looking at how to structure episodes, but they actually wrote them. And there was a kind of triangle of translation, you know, actually most of them spoke pretty good English, but then they would write in Khmer, be translated, and we would look at them and try and modulate them. But in some ways, that show, even though the budget was really tiny, the government of Cambodia gave us, you know, incredible filming rights. We didn't have to pay to film in these incredible locations with, you know, thousands of extras. So it actually looks pretty cool as a show. And it was an amazing experience living there. So, yeah, that was a great experience.
Do you remember what your ambition was as a writer at that time? Was it, how can I get any sort of job that will pay me to write? Or did you have bigger ambitions to write films, to write TV? Do you recall what those ambitions were at the time?
Yeah, both of those things are true. Like I was trying to survive and I was happy to take any opportunity that came my way. But then you think, I want to survive in the industry I want to be in. Like, I mean, I'd done other jobs and I think it's really hard if you're doing another job to find that time and to find the mental energy if you're working a really long shift somewhere to then go on and write. You have to get up really early. It's possible, but it's a tricky way of doing it. It felt like this was an easier fit. Like I was writing on someone else's show, admittedly, but then I was always writing my own stuff in the background. So in Cambodia, I was writing a script put together, which was a thriller that eventually got sold once I sold Child 44. But I, you know, no, I mean, I didn't have an agent at that time. Actually, I did have an agent, but it wasn't selling. I think it eventually found someone, but it was a bit of a struggle. But I was always writing my own stuff whilst doing those shows. And so in a sense, what that was doing was affording me the time. And actually, in the long run, because when I was living in Cambodia, they paid for an apartment. So I didn't really have many living expenses. And although the salary wasn't great, I wasn't really spending it. So I saved it. And once I came back to the UK, I decided to write Child 44. And I had enough money saved up to write that novel. I was able to kind of pull my living expenses down and just spend 2 years writing the novel. But, you know, so it was a mix of, you know, I didn't have any. If radio had come up as an opportunity, I would have taken that. I don't know. I would have taken, I think I went for, I spoke to someone in educational writing. So I was going for anything to keep me in that sphere and to pay my way whilst my original stuff hopefully got better and better and better. That was the strategy. So it was both.
Yeah. So it seems like this combination of you were young and bold, you were willing to take on whatever, and you had structured your life around writing any means possible. And I'm curious, I mean, that it seems, and we've interviewed so many people and it seems there's no one way into a writing career. People go into it at all sorts of ways. And yours is one more data point to that proof. But if you were to advise someone who's wanting to embark on a screenwriting career today, what's changed since the days you got started, maybe making it more easy or more difficult than how you jumped in? And would you have any advice for someone who's hoping to get their foot in the door?
Well, I think the first thing you said is like absolutely true, which is everyone has their own path. And I think it's really important that you acknowledge that yourself when you're on your journey, that, you know, you have to take the opportunities that arise to you. They'll be particular to you, like you'll meet someone or something will, you know, come across your way. And I have friends that have tried to sculpt it in the sense they're trying to kind of almost like imagine it in the future. Like they don't want to do, for example, soap operas because they think they have a bad name or they don't want to start out there. They want to go straight in it and it to be like an Oscar nominated movie. And some people can pull that off. Like the first thing they pull off is one of their best things, but it's a tricky, you know, it's tricky to know. And I think you should be nimble footed because the opportunities that arise to you will be particular to you and you should go in that direction. I think, you know, for film now, they just make far less film. That's the issue. Like there are just far fewer films being made that go. I think it's a much tougher industry than it was. And it felt tough when I was trying to get in. It's just tougher now. I think people are always looking for spins on something that is commercial. And so I think that sense of having an eye on both what you really love and is your voice and having a sense of what other people want as well is helpful. And I think some people can see that as a kind of a compromise, but I think there is, you know, if you can find something that you really love that also intersects with something lots of other people love, that seems to be a smart place to start. And then you can grow towards the point where you're like, okay, I'm going to do something no one has ever done before. And because I've done these other things, people will come to it. Starting at that point is tricky, I think. So again, you know, but even that sounds like you have to weigh things up strategically. And some people just don't think like that. Some people are just going to sit down and going to write something that is completely new and bold and that is kind of groundbreaking and people might love it or might not. So I think that thing of that you mentioned at the beginning is what I keep coming back to, which is you should take advice with a pinch of salt, really.
Mm. Yeah.
Just a question on this idea of being nimble-footed. I really like it. And there may be writers who are listening who are willing to take any opportunity that comes their way, but maybe they're not sure where to start or which organizations they might or how approach or literally where might they go to find people that they can connect with. What would your advice be for anyone looking to connect and broaden their network?
Well, I can only speak to the things that I did. And one of the things I did was cast my net very wide. Like I always loved radio plays, but I just never seemed to know who was doing them. I don't know that world at all. Lots of people came up through in the UK, particularly, and I'm not sure so much in the US. Podcasts now, I mean, those didn't exist when I was writing. Podcasts seem to be a great way to, but I don't know how that world works, particularly whether you come in and say, listen, I want to work as on a nonfiction one that involves some creative writing of that. I think that sense of really being open, but also open to opportunities that you might not have thought about in your dream scenario. And certainly when I was going through the newspaper and looking at things, I would have done journalism, but I didn't have that opportunity. It didn't seem to arise because I think journalism is a great way in because you're writing and you're thinking about stories, that true stories, but you're thinking about how to present them. But I didn't, that just never came across my path as a chance. I think I actually applied for some journalist posts and didn't get them. But I love reading newspapers and really great journalism, such as, you know, whether it's in the Atlantic or the New Yorker now. But that has, I've never done that as a career. Plays, I've always loved theater. And now there are lots of kind of bursaries that might work. I might have applied for those. I think I did apply for some theater bursaries because I'd done theater in college, but they didn't come to anything. So again, it's like that didn't, I can't speak to how that would work, but I remember trying that. So I think I truly tried everything. And I mean, the really bizarre thing about Child 44 is I was working on an adaptation of a short story for a production company, and it was about serial killers. Now, I hadn't really read much true crime. I'd read very famous thrillers, Silence of the Lambs, all of those, but true crime had not been something I particularly dedicated much time to. I don't know whether I'd read many accounts at all, actually thinking about it. But suddenly this short story required me to have a knowledge of true crime. So I just went and bought all these true crime books and I was reading them and I thought, oh, they're really interesting. Some of these stories are really about much more. And that was when I came across the story of Chikatilo in the Soviet Union. And I was like, this is an amazing story. I want to tell this story. But it was almost like a kind of, I stumbled across it. You know, there's lots of stumbling. And I think you know when you stumble across something that you have a strong reaction to. And if you trust that, that's a kind of powerful signal.
Well, let's dig a little deeper into that. Because Child 44, that really seemed to have exploded your career. And we read somewhere that you started it as a treatment. And then you had feedback from your agent saying, maybe this should be a novel. Can you tell us a bit more about that? And why was that the advice?
Well, you know, the treatment thing always sounds like it has to be a screenplay. A treatment is just an outline, a story outline, which is, and I do it for novels as well. I write like a 20-page outline. In fact, my new novel, which is not called People, which I'm working on now, I think I wrote, it was really detailed. It just came out like a 20,000-word outline, which is crazy because it's only going to be like 70,000 words. And I think that process is like, what is the shape of this story? What's in it? Do I enjoy writing the outline? Does anyone enjoy reading it? It's like a test, you know, it's like, and you don't have to share them. They can just be for yourself. But with this, I wrote this outline. I loved it. And I thought it was full of really interesting historical details and character. And I didn't have a book agent. I only had a film agent. So I shared it with him. And his perspective was, as a screenplay, it's like, it's about the Soviet Union. It's dark. No one was making stories about the Soviet Union. They don't really make them now. And so he was like, it's going to be really tough to write. And in some ways, it's interesting because at that point, I was like, well, I'm going to write it as a book because I don't need anyone to give me money. I don't need to have it funded. You're like a free agent as a novelist. So it wasn't that it didn't work as a screenplay, and therefore I wrote it as a novel. And what's interesting is now at this point in time, I think I would not write something that was an original screenplay without writing the book first. So Class of 09, which I'm working on, which is the TV show that I'm working on now, I wrote as an original TV show, but didn't have a book. London Spy didn't have a book, and Mother, Father, Son didn't have a book. Obviously, The Versace was based on a book, but now I wouldn't do that again. I would always write a book and maybe adapt it or not. Because in some ways, I think you have to write the book to write the screenplay. It's like you need all the detail to know how to whittle it down. And if you don't do that, if you just write the screenplay, everyone wants the book anyway. They're like, oh, so what did my character do when they were, you know, 12 or something? So in some ways, once you finish the story, everyone wants all the detail. So you kind of think, well, you might as well start with the book and then go to the screenplay. But yeah, so that was, in some ways, I've gone full circle, which is that's the best way, to write a screenplay, which is to, you have to understand everything and then kind of focus it. And with this story, I thought, if you write the screenplay, would you do all the reading? Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But with this, I knew I had to. I knew I had to describe in detail what these shops were like, what the Moscow streets were like. I knew I had to get a sense of that. And sometimes you have to get a sense of that, even though you might not put it in the book. I think the reader can tell if you don't know the detail, even if you don't put the detail down.
I wonder if we can zoom in a little on this treatment. And for some people that might not be familiar with the treatment, do you use a particular structure for how you go to fill in the blanks and kind of the prompts we're using? What does that actually look like, the treatment?
The treatment is, short paragraphs, and they move at a real speed, and there's limited description, but they should be as vivid enough to give a sense of the scenes. So in some ways, they're like vignettes, series of vignettes that follow through. So a chapter becomes a paragraph, a page is, you might get through, page becomes 20 pages in terms of content. So you're telescoping and compressing and summarizing. At some points, I go into quite a lot of detail to give an indication of what might happen in terms of, in terms of its visual style. So my outlines are pretty detailed, but, some people write even more, like 20,000 words. They might almost write it as a novella, and then it kind of expands again. And some people write far less. It might just be 10 pages. So again, there's no rule about it. It's what feels natural to you. It depends what you're doing with it. If you're trying to convince someone to give you funding, then you have to be vivid. If you're trying to show someone a plot shape, then it doesn't have to have as much detail. So a lot depends on your reader, as it always does.
And do you, I know you say it depends on the writer, but do you go into detail on the characters? Do you have little sections where you explore the character in your treatment?
I don't break off into bios. In fact, they're one of my least favorite things to write. You had to write them on TV shows, these bios. And I think they're slightly artificial. I think it's interesting to discover character through what they do and discover character through the fabric of the story rather than here is a one-page summary of this person. And by the way, I've read lots of those and they tend to have a style, which is, this person seems like this, but in fact, they're this. And of course, they're super complicated and they're, and there's a way of presenting that becomes very repetitive because those things are quite artificial to write. Whereas if you're writing your story, the character will come out through the natural elements of it. So I think bios aren't a great read. I don't know whether other people, whether other professionals love to read them. I've never liked them. And I'm always a bit suspicious of them. When you work on these long running shows, you go in and they give you this big, they call it the Bible of the show. And they always have these character bios and, I never find them that useful, particularly even to read. So I'm a bit skeptical about those. I think if your characters are embedded in the story you're telling, it should come across that way. That would be my preference. But they look kind of professional on a document, but I don't know how much you get from them. And I don't know how fun they are to read, particularly.
I'm curious about your transition. Well, I'm not sure if it is a transition or just the extension of your writing from screenwriting to writing novels. How was that process for you, writing Child 44? And were there any challenges in moving to a longer form content?
I mean, I wrote Child 44 as a trilogy, and then I wrote The Farm. And whilst I was working on The Farm, I had this idea for London Spy. And it was, I really wanted to tell a story about, it was the first gay story that I worked on with the two gay protagonists. And actually, it came up against a lot of obstacles because of that, because there, at that time, particularly, there weren't really very gay-led thrillers at all. And there was a case in London about a spy who had been murdered. And even though it wasn't based on his life, I was caught up by the way in which his story was, Gareth Williams, his story was presented, and the way in which the mystery was dismissed as soon as his personal life was brought into it. And so I got interested, and he didn't, as far as we know, have a partner. So I don't know anything about his personal life in that sense. So that was the kind of real life spark. And then I thought, well, if I put that in with a partner, and that partner knew this person very well, and then this person disappeared, the mystery of it and trying to solve the mystery of who your lover was very interesting to me. And that character in that piece, I always felt, you know, it was a first person narrative. It was this person's falling in love and then losing that, the love of their life, and then trying to work out the mystery. So I knew it was from this person's point of view, but I also knew this person wasn't like an author, and I couldn't work out what they would write down. It felt like that felt contrary to who they were. They were someone who went clubbing and partying, and they had like a tough job. So it was like, when would they, would it be a diary? It just felt very literary. It felt like it was taking, I couldn't work out what it would be as a novel. It just felt very visual to me. And so at that point, I thought, well, this isn't a story that I want to necessarily write as a book. Should I just go straight to it as a script? And I wasn't, you know, I was nervous about it. I hadn't written that before, but it was quite easy at that point because I had an agent to say, listen, I'm going to try this and then we can send it out. And because you're known, people will read it. Although it still essentially goes into a slush pile, maybe kind of slightly elevated slush pile. And people reacted. I think that was a treatment. People reacted to that. It was set up at Working Title, not funded by the BBC. So still completely speculative. The fact that I'd written a novel didn't really count for very much at all. So it was very kind of like tentative. And I wrote the script, the first draft, and the BBC really liked it and decided they wanted to read the treatment for the second episode. And then once they liked that, they said, we're going to fund it. But I was really surprised. It wasn't like I felt like, oh, because I've written books that had done well, this was an inevitability. And the truth is that often they're quite skeptical that novelists can make the switch. So it was really thrilling. It was a really exciting moment to get that commission. And it was kind of one of the most exciting points in my career to think, oh, wow, you know, I could write this story, particularly since it was also this gay love story. It felt like, you know, two things, my first TV show, and it was headed by this gay character played by Ben Whishaw. So suddenly I was like, that's, you know, it was a very exciting moment. But it didn't feel like it was guaranteed in any way. It was like a real surprise.
That's really interesting to hear about you talking about being part of the elevated slush pile. It still seems like at every point throughout your career, feels like you've fought hard or been bold enough to just push through with the different ideas you've had. Just going back to Child 44, you said it took you 2 years to write that. Can you tell us a little bit about what that first draft looked like? Were you just, you had the treatment, which was quite lengthy. What did that process of writing look like for you?
Yeah, it's a great question, because in some ways you forget that first novel attempt because it's really so hard. Because I think the hard thing was not this. I love the story. I love the research. The research really actually got me through. There were moments of real crisis when you're like, I'm spending 2 years or something. It's completely speculative. It's not set up. I have no literary agent. I had a film agent, but I didn't have a book agent. No one has said they like this. No one has said they want it. And I could spend 2 years writing this and it's going to come to nothing. And there are, you know, if I really go back to those days, I was living with my partner at the time, and I was paying as much rent as I could. And, you know, I could literally watch my savings dropping as you're kind of writing. And I remember this, it's psychologically tough. Like, I remember, you know, people talk about you as an aspiring writer, or maybe you'll make it, and you have to really kind of, you can feel the skepticism when you say, oh, because I always lay my cards on the table and say, oh, I'm writing a book. And there are other people who keep them close to their chest because they don't want the pressure and they don't want that moment where it doesn't work out to be the humiliation of it. But I always felt like it was easier just to tell people. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work. But I could never hold it from people. So I was like, I'm writing this book, and you're looking at people thinking, wow, they don't believe in it. They don't think it's going to make it. They think it's a pipe dream. And if I really pull my mind back to those moments, I remember how hard it was and getting up in the morning. Because I write in the morning. I love writing. I don't really write in the evening particularly. maybe some rewriting, but the morning is my best time. And you get up and it's cold and you're sitting there thinking, am I wasting? Is this a waste of time? You have to push through that and carry on. But the inspiring thing about it is, if you can take that energy and it makes you sharper and you think, wow, what am I missing on this page? You know, if that thought, am I wasting my time? How am I not wasting my time? How do I get this to be as good as it can possibly be? And the discipline of that is tough, but it also, in some ways, I still try to recreate that. I still try and go back to that first novel feeling and think, there's something really great about asking those really difficult questions of yourself and pushing through and thinking, is this right? What am I missing? How do I get this as good as it can be? So there's something wonderful about that first experience, and there's something really tough about it.
Thanks for the honesty and sharing, Tom. We'd like to go into, and maybe this is deeper into the treatment, but your relationship with plotting and planning. It sounds like the treatment is that document that helps you do the planning. What's your relationship with plotting early on in the book? Is it something that comes natural to you? Is it something you try to do first and foremost before you start the writing? Or what's your approach?
Yeah, well, I hinted at it earlier with character. Like, I think the two things are interwoven. The things that happen and who people are completely interwoven to me. And I think plotting is, I mean, when you get it wrong, you can spend forever trying to fix it. And I've experienced this in TV shows, particularly when you're looking at the edit and thinking I got the plotting wrong. But I think they're interwoven. I love putting it down. You can tell when it flows. And when there's a break, then there's a serious problem and you try and fix it. But there is nothing better than when you feel like you've got this flow of scenes that works really wonderfully. And you can call that plotting, or getting the story right, or seeing, you know, there's that something about, and this actually goes back way back to that experience of reading The Slush Pile, where I would pick things up and they would have a great opening. And then you could just feel the meander, this meandering that kicks in. And then they would try to counterbalance it with these big things that would happen. And then it would meander again. And you start to spot that and think, well, what's going on here? What is this meandering feeling? How do I address that? That's a series. So you start thinking about that from a very, very early age. And it's interesting because some stories naturally have a lot of plot. But the story I'm writing now is my first romance. And I want that to really fly. I don't want it to feel like it meanders. And so again, it's like trying to take those storytelling techniques and apply them to a very different genre. And in Cold People, the plotting was really tricky. That was because it was such an epic story with a multiple characters, trying to work out when to move to each character, when you felt like you had enough that you could move on, or you hadn't done enough and it would felt too abrupt to move on. So the plotting for Cold People was tricky, actually. But Child 44, that was tricky too, but it was really fun to plot that out. Yeah, no, I think to me, it's like at the heart, I love plotting. I love working. Yeah, it's a delight. So I actually quite like writing outlines. You can really tell when they're working or not. I think outlines don't, you can't hide anything with something like a great description or something. It's like it either flows or it doesn't.
Are there any methodologies that you subscribe to or that you find helpful? We know some people like Save the Cat, Parle's part of the Story Grid editorial methodology. Are any helpful for you?
I don't know if I've been that technical about it. I think on the only time I've ever really, you know, in with episodes, we break them down on boards and we literally just break them down to scenes. So like it's the one slug line for the scene. So you're like episode 7 and you write down, you know, the 15 scenes that they are on a board, and you can look at them and you can kind of, you have to look at them and think, how do they flow? And that's a really kind of compressed form of breaking a story down. But other than that, I don't have any, I don't know if I would put it in a methodology. No.
And for someone who is looking to embark on writing a thriller, I wonder if you have any advice, any sort of tips on things that must exist in that book. Maybe it's not as hard and fast as any rules, but maybe there are sort of archetypes of characters or set pieces.
I would say that it has to have some burning passion that is from you. And that doesn't mean it needs to have a burning passion that is near to your life. It can be a passion that you're really into a subject. You're really into it. But people feel that. People can pick up something and they can see if there's a mechanical element to it. And what everyone is looking for is when it comes alive with some love of the subject. And, you know, I love listening to, you know, in the UK, Radio 4, partly because, you know, it just covers, whenever someone is talking, whether they're talking about clouds or farming, they tend to be so into it. Like, even if I'm not into it as a subject, I hear their passion and I can feel myself getting pulled in. And absolutely the same is true for books. And I think if you want to write a really great thriller and you find a story, there are so many stories out there, but you find a story that you have a really strong connection to, it will shine through immediately. And if you're writing something and you feel like I'm doing it strategically or I'm doing it with an eye to something else, I think people will tell. And it would be better to be rough and slightly more obscure, but full of this energy of love for the subject, than to be kind of clinical and objective. I don't think that works in the end. I think passion and love for the material always shines through.
Well, let's use that passion as a bridge into your next book, which is coming out in January, Cold People. Can you tell us a bit about it? And what was the passion, the driving force for writing this book? And just to give people a little overview, it involves aliens in Antarctica. So can you tell us a little bit about the passion that drove you into that book?
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved science fiction. I've loved science fiction since I was a kid. I love watching it. I love movies. I love Spielberg, Lucas, Zemeckis. I love reading it, although I came to the reading it because they don't give it to you at school. It took me a while to find the science fiction. I mean, I read some as a kid, like Dune, but then, you know, Isaac Asimov, I came to later. Philip K. Dick, I came to later, but then I loved those stories. And I was always curious why I'd never written one. And I think I was like, you've got this love for this genre. You've read a lot of it. You've watched a lot of it. Why have you never tried to write your own? And I think they're daunting. They're really hard to write. And I think part of it is, you know, if you're starting out, you're worried about being laughed at. And if you take on these big science fiction things, it's very easy to laugh at science fiction premises. So you have to work really hard to give them a heart and to give them grounding. And then I think I love the escapist element. I love picking it up and feeling like I'm being taken somewhere else into a world that I hadn't experienced before. That's wonderful. But then it's about how do you make that world that's other about the world that we're in today. And interestingly, I think science fiction can talk about stories that have become very political and very provocative and very divisive in a way that is very accessible because you're not talking about them exactly in terms of a policy or a country. You're not critiquing a prime minister or a politician. You're not getting into the quagmire of those discussions. You're just talking about ideas. And you're saying, hey, what would it be like if it was like this? What would the world be like if we experienced it in a way that has been experienced actually by other people, but in a different form? And so you start to be able to play with stories that would be very difficult to tell if you were telling them straight, so to speak, in terms of like, oh, this is the world over here, I'm telling that story. And so that came into the mix. And then partly it was written during lockdown, and I really wanted to have that escape. Everyone wanted to escape during lockdown. And so it had this energy of escape and, you know, this feeling of, okay, I can forget about this awful experience for a couple of hours. And the TV shows that I watch and the books that I read during lockdown were like that. And I read a lot of nonfiction for research, and I found it really hard to read nonfiction during lockdown because it felt really peculiar to be reading about whatever it was, a financial crash, or I just wanted to read something about other worlds. And so it came out of lots of these different energies that came together. And yeah, that was the impulse.
Mm. What did day one look like on writing that book?
This book, I think, and Colpe and Child 44, and they both begin with C, were like the hardest novels I've written. This one, because I was truly daunted by the genre. I think it's so hard. And I think you're immediately walking. It's so hard to make anything feel credible, even if you're writing your own. Like, I mean, The Farm is based on a very personal experience that I went through. And even writing that was hard to make it feel credible, even though I knew exactly what happened and it had happened. Trying to make that seem real was hard. So trying to make something that hasn't happened that is, you know, that has this element of being very difficult and unreal, real, was really tough. And so I had in some ways a very similar feeling that I had Child 44, which, am I wasting my time? Is this going to work? Am I good enough to do that? All of those anxieties that actually most writers have I had again in a very intense way with it. So the beginning was really tough. And interesting, we were talking about plotting. This one, I knew a lot of the story, but it wasn't intricately plotted. And I thought I had to kind of discover this as I go along. And that is really hard because you're moving through trying to work out which elements of the story you want to continue and which elements you don't want to continue. And not having that clear map means you move at a much slower pace. And you have, I mean, the book is just over 100,000 words, but there were versions that were 150,000 words. There's so much that was in it that got pulled back, that was too much, that was taking it in a different direction, that pulled down the, because there's so much research that you can do. And there's so many possibilities in terms of characters and detail that it was a real process of discovery. So, you know, for all of my talk about plotting, Cold People was a very different plotting experience, actually. Yeah. Day one to day whatever, because it took a long time to write because I was working on TV shows, was as hard as Child 44. Yeah.
I'm really curious about what you said about how difficult it was to make real what is potentially unreal. And I'm curious about what that, I don't know if there are any thoughts you can share about when you then looked at the first draft. As you say, you had versions that were 150,000 words. When you're looking at those versions and trying to edit it down, what were you looking out for to cut out or to amend?
There are lots of things. I think one of the things you look for is research that is amazingly fascinating. Like the research books on Antarctica, obviously about Antarctica itself, but in this book, Genetic Engineering, it's so interesting. And sometimes you get so caught up in it that you want to share it. And there's a point where it has to be folded into the narrative. It can't kind of just move into a footnote where you move down to these detailed descriptions of things that don't really add and that become a little bit like, I found these interesting facts and I want to share them. So that's an easy thing to cut out. I think the research, and I had that with Child 44, I knew that because there's so much in the Soviet Union, there's so much that's interesting. You know, if anything becomes performative with the research, I look at all this research I've done, that goes. I also think there's just a kind of, you can tell when you're holding people and when you're not, I think, or hopefully you can feel when a chapter is trying to do something and maybe moves into the realm of, it just loses its grip for some reason. It's really hard to define that. There's a kind of, you know, because there aren't any rules for that. Some chapters are very long and they hold a spell over the reader. And some short chapters actually don't hold any spell over the reader. So there's not like there's a length question. You're always just trying to judge whether it has that grip on people. And you're always trying to imagine it from the reader's point of view. And then the structural thing is just, you know, have I spent so long in this story that you've lost a sense of the other stories and the balance? And so then it becomes about, okay, I need to get that balance back. So that was a part of the compression as well. So there's a lots of different things you're looking out for. And in the end, you get to a point where you'll finish the book and some people, you know, it's interesting. Some people want more of a character and it will be a very personal reaction. They love this character and they're just a kind of like someone, they kind of almost come in as a brief appearance and they're like, I wanted to know more about that person. And you're interested in it because maybe that character could have done with more, or maybe it was just someone had a really strong reaction to that character for whatever reason. So, you know, that question that is never kind of closed off. The Publishers Weekly, when they read it, I mean, he was really interested in one of the characters who was traveling in this mass migration. He was like, I was really interested in this character. I wanted to know more about them. And I found it really interesting because I was like, oh, I like that character too, but, you know, I don't know what I would have done with that person. But I find it fascinating that, you know, that question never stops, I think.
Right. And talking about characters, I think it's interesting. You've said, you had this line, I read it in an interview. You said, if you get the combination of characters right, you can draw enormous drama from very confined spaces. And actually, that's quite evident in Cold People, where you have, like you say, small, like you have a character like the captain of the ship, that vessel, when he's trying to save a bunch of people, but it's in a very small setting. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about any of the characters that fascinated you in Cold People and how you thought of them. You could pick, if there's one character in particular, Eliza or Otto.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because that's a continent where you have enormous space. It's vast. But because we can't survive in that cold, we live in very confined spaces. And so there's this really interesting contradiction between space and confined space there, which I found really intriguing. And then during the winter, you're essentially, you know, hibernating. And there's this peculiar claustrophobia. And one of the things I found really interesting in Antarctica as a location is there is obviously the spectacle of it, which is, you know, everyone says is awesome and has this kind of a grandeur, but there's also the psychological element. And that becomes very interesting, like who is able to cope with that cold? Who's able to cope with people? And actually one of the big tests for people going to Antarctica are these psychological tests about how they hold up under pressure. So this was about putting together that group of people, and they're very close together. They have no one else to depend upon apart from each other. You can't go and just kind of go off to the cinema or go, you know, for the walk. You're in these confined spaces and trying to think about what are the most interesting mixes of characters there. And they're under enormous pressure trying to survive. But even then, you know, even in the prelude, which is about, you know, the testing of people going to Antarctica to the survival station, I found that really interesting, the questions they ask. I would absolutely fail those questions. There's no way they would send me to a scientific research post for winter. So I found that really interesting. I was like, oh, I wouldn't get through their psych test. But there's this, also this thing that no one knows. There's this disaster movie quality to it, which is you think someone is absolutely dependable and they seem completely together in the real world, and you send them to Antarctica and they crack within weeks. So there's this element of mystery as well. Like no one really knows who can survive down there. And so I found that really interesting, and who's going to crack and who doesn't. And that combination of the psychological and the physical really interesting.
And so a lot of what you're talking about sounds like raising stakes, actually, because actually as the story continues, there are more and more constraints and complications brought about on the characters, which means that the tension just constantly rises. That's my thoughts on it. I'm curious about whether you have any thoughts on where writers can sometimes go wrong when it comes to keeping tension in a book or raising the stakes.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, because again, it's this thing of, you know, I think tension has a mystery about it. I mean, you know, you can have scenes that are very simple, and there's this incredible scene in Persona. And I think it's one of the characters smashes a glass, I think, on it. It's on a Swedish island. And she smashes a glass, and there's a tiny fragment of glass embedded in the grass on this island. And she just doesn't take it out of the ground. And she's watching this woman who she's got this strange relationship walk across. And it's like, is she going to step on the glass or not? And nothing is really going to happen. It would be like a cut. And it's so tense. And it's so fraught with, because it's fraught with their character interaction and how weird it is to be her, to be watching to see if she's going to cut her foot or not. And then you can have enormous stakes. You can make the end of the world, you know, like, and you're watching it thinking, well, you know, I don't know. It doesn't have the, you feel like you've seen it before, or you feel like they've decided they need big stakes, so the whole plan is at stake. And that thing where everything at stake, so it feels in a way like nothing is at stake. And then other times you get to an end and you think, well, the stakes weren't big enough. So it's almost like you're dealing with a situation where there are no rules, where, you know, you can, in theory, put huge stakes on the table, and people are like, I don't buy it. Or you can put very intimate stakes and people are completely engrossed and absorbed in it. And again, that's the magic and mystery of trying to work out what is holding people and what isn't. But I don't think that one is an easy one to break down in a kind of series of rules. It's certainly not true that it's on a graph that, you know, the bigger the stakes, the more the tension. I don't think, in some ways, I think people have got very suspicious now of those, you know, easy big stakes. That really... Okay, I've seen that before.
And I quite like the way you describe that, though. Like you say, it can be confined or can be in a very small, seemingly small stake situation. But the interaction of the characters and the setting itself can add to the tension. So it's very helpful just to hear that.
Well, you know, I'm working on this love story now. I mean, the stakes of a love story are really just your own feelings. Like nothing else depends on it. Nothing in the world will depend on your love story, really, apart from your friends being happy for you and your family being happy for you. And so in some sense, as a love story, the smallest stakes possible, but we all are absolutely gripped by them when they're great. And we're like desperate for the love story to work or someone to get out of a, you know, a dysfunctional relationship. But the stakes are as small as they could possibly be. It's just it's that character's situation. You're not trying to root it to the world in terms of a circumstance. So that's an example of the stakes feeling enormous and yet ultimately actually very personal and small.
Love it. Tom, you've talked about the importance of finishing a book. Did you struggle with finishing Cold People?
Yeah, I did actually. There was a real struggle, partly because I wasn't writing novels full time. I was doing the TV shows. And so the rhythm kept getting broken. One of the things I always value is, even if it's a little bit doing it regularly, you know that with learning languages, you know that with learning anything, but I do think it's really important with books. I think, you know, if you just keep moving forward, and it's not that question of, you know, you have to do 200 words or 300 words a day, but it's keeping it alive in your brain so that when you're going for a walk or when you're doing whatever you're doing, it's still in your head, it's still percolating. And I think what happens if you stop, when you start again, there's that, you know, there's that friction of having to start, you know, the boulder moving again. It's like, you have to read over everything. You have to kind of remember, you know, even the words you use, like when you start again, if you start using a word that you've used loads before, you're like, oh, well, am I repeating that piece of information or that piece of information about the character? So you have to relearn the book every time there's a gap. And so there were, you know, there's that sense, and it's not the best way to write if you're constantly interrupted by life, whatever life might be. In this case, it was TV shows. So this one was a tricky one to finish because of the interruptions. And then you had different research. So I'd be researching, whether it was Versace or researching for this FBI show about the FBI. And suddenly I'm like, oh, I've forgotten all my Antarctica research. I need to, you know, read new books. And so that becomes a tricky way to work for sure. And I would definitely not recommend. You know, people have very complicated lives, though, so it's hard sometimes to avoid those interruptions. But the interruptions are really tricky, I think. They're, for whatever you're doing, for whatever reasons, they're a tricky one.
Are you changing the way you're writing the romance novel right now, given kind of your insights with Cold People? And I assume you still have a lot going on in your life as well.
But not production. Production is all-consuming. Like, when you're in production, anything else, it's like from the first thing in the beginning of the day, right? And I was writing during production as well. So it was, you know, on this FBI show, it was all consuming and at weekends as well. So it was kind of no social life. No, it was really tough. And then, so you just don't have any time at all. There was not the possibility of writing during that. So there was a big gap there. But this, because I'm editing, I mean, editing is more like a regular job. And so I can get up early. I can get up and do 2 to 3 hours before I do my kind of, my inverted commas, my regular job. And then that is at least enough for it to feel like it's flowing and it's constantly moving forward and alive and it's in my head and I'm not having to relearn everything again. So yes, that is completely different. And it feels actually much easier, has a much better flow. And interruptions are a real obstacle.
Thanks for sharing that. Hearing and witnessing the story of your journey, you've gone from not having much money and not having much success to what seems like you've built a successful career for yourself as a writer. And I'm curious how your relationship with money has evolved over these years and maybe your understanding on what it takes to make it as a writer, as a career, what you've learned over that journey. Any insights or thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. You know, it's impossible to separate the two because obviously money is time. Money is the ability to write. And, you know, if you look back, if you go into a kind of an academic sense of it and you look back, 100 years, the only people who could write were people who were wealthy. I think my parents were very successful when I was kind of young. They had a furniture business, did very well. And then during one of the recessions, you know, came close to bankruptcy. And so I was always had an acute aware, and I could see how much pressure that placed them under as a couple. And so from a very early age, I always had the sense that money was more than just buying things. It was about your mood. It was about your ability to, in their case, to love each other and to, you know, to be parents. And in this case, the ability to write required a certain amount of financial stability. So even when I didn't have very much money, I saved a lot of it. So on the Cambodia show and on the storylining, I never really spent very much. I saved a lot as a proportion. And so that when I wrote Child 44, I'd worked out enough to finish it. And I'm very lucky that my hobbies are relatively, you know, reading is a relatively cheap hobby. Going to the cinema used to be much cheaper, but it's still reasonable. The theater has become crazily expensive, but didn't used to be. Like the National Theater used to be. I mean, and in Broadway now, I mean, now it's insane, but it used to be that you could go to theater for less than it costs today. And that's not me critiquing theater particularly. Like I know pandemic has been really tough for the theaters and stuff. But, you know, when you're looking at Broadway now and tickets are $200, you're like, that's a lot. But I used to see loads of plays. I remember, you know, they had those kind of £20 tickets and all that kind of stuff. So it used to be that my hobbies were pretty cheap. And then I was just, you know, try to work it out in terms of what I need to finish something. And now my sense is I have the chance now to write this book. And I don't know whether, so it was the same with Poor People. I didn't know whether it would be commercial. I knew science fiction is a risky genre to do. But I thought, well, I've worked enough to be able to afford to take the chance, I think. I'm not particularly chasing anything. I just want to write the stories that I always dreamed of writing. And Cold People was one of those. And I love it. I love writing it. And I hope people like it. But it's certainly not written with any strategy or any kind of commercial eye. And I think, you know, there was a real bewilderment that I hadn't written another thriller. But, you know, I think thrillers are really hard. You know, there are very few cases I come across where I'm like, that's a really interesting story that I could tell or I have a strong connection to it. And so I just couldn't, I just didn't have enough sense of I could just keep doing that. I had to, you know, there were very few. I have another one that I'm thinking about, but, you know, they're few and far between that I come across those cases and fall in love with them and think I should tell that for some reason.
Thanks for sharing, Dan.
I'm curious about, and just rules and rituals when you sit down to write. Do you have anything that particularly works for you? A place that you sit or a certain guideline that you follow for yourself that helps you write?
I get up really early. Not crazily early, like 4 a.m., but I love writing with the sunrise. And if I'm not writing like 6, 5:30, 5, that kind of time, I love the stillness of that period. I love watching the sun come up. I think it's a real, that there's something about having that kind of clean head and having, and not feeling restless, because you're kind of quite tired. And there's a kind of real, like you go into this world for me. And I think some people much prefer the evening. They have a similar energy in the evening. And so it's not like there's a rule about that. Like they can do it like at midnight to 2 a.m. or something. I could never do that time. I just get sleepy and I could never really, I didn't have the freshness. But it's that sense of the world being quiet. But then again, there's no, like, I know some people that start at 10 a.m. and love that through to 4 p.m. To me, that's like the worst period. It's just too much going on. There's too many interruptions. It feels like that's when the world's busy. So mine is when the world is still. And other than that, not really. I don't listen to music. The only time I listen to music is if I'm rewriting and I'm in a public place and I need to block out like whatever the sounds are. And that I taught myself late. I could never do that when I was in my 20s. But then I started traveling quite a lot. And so I just learned how to listen to soundtracks, which I listen to, not singing. I can't listen to words. But then I can kind of rewrite on a plane or something or on a train or in a coffee shop. But you learn these tricks and they're very kind of particular to you. So I would not say to anyone you have to get up at 6 a.m. to write if your best time is 10 p.m. or midday. But I think listen to those things. But once you know them, you should protect them. Like I know that if I start writing at 8 a.m., I'll be annoyed and it won't be as good. And that's a ridiculous cycle. There's no reason if I wanted to do 4 hours, why I couldn't start at 8 a.m. But I know that if I start at 8 a.m., I'll be like, this is too late. And it won't have the same feel. And I know that if I have to go and do something at, you know, 10 a.m., that interruption, even if I could time it, will weigh on me. So I try to make sure that I have enough space between things. I don't feel like, oh, wait a minute, I've got to go and get ready for something.
I really like that idea that once you figure out what works for you, protect it. I think many of us struggle with protecting our sacred time.
It is hard.
Thank you.
What's next for you? So you've got Cold People coming out in January, which we can't wait for. We'll make sure to share a link to it. You're writing the romance book. We're rooting for you. What else can we look forward to coming down the pike?
So the big FX FBI show comes out on Hulu in the US and Disney Plus around the world. It comes out on the same day and date. And it's with Brian Tyree Henry from Atlanta, Kate Mara, who was in House of Cards. She played the journalist House of Cards. She's amazing. They're an amazing cast. And it's about this group of FBI agents through their career. So it's across time. And that comes out in sort of early summer. And so, yeah, those are the two things. And then the romance will, you know, that'll be finished next year. So that'll come out the following year.
Amazing. Well, maybe we'll have you back to talk about yet another genre that you've mastered and dipped your creative toes into. Well, Tom, thank you so much. Tom, where's the best place to stay in touch with you?
Oh, yeah, I'm on all social media as well. Instagram, Twitter. You can message me. I try to answer everything. Yeah, if anything, any questions, yeah, get in touch. If you like the book, get in touch.
Amazing. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for tuning in to the London Writers Salon podcast. If you enjoyed our chat and you'd like to join us for the next one, please visit londonwriterssalon.com for more information on how to become a member. As a member, you will have access to our interview archive, to our workshops, and our cozy online writing community. Whatever kind of writer you are, it is an excellent place to make new creative connections and focus on your craft.
And if you struggle to find time to write, you're welcome to write with us at our daily Writer's Hour writing sessions. It runs Monday to Friday, four times a day, and all you need is the desire to write, something to write with, and something to cheers us with. We think it's the world's best virtual co-writing space for writers, creatives, or frankly, anyone who just needs to get some work done. Visit writershour.com to sign up and join us. Until we write again.